Welcome to Popcorn Talk, leader of movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. Three, two, one, now.
Alrighty, I think we're on air, Liana. We did it.
Hi, Jeff. Nice to see you.
I caught you mid-coffee drink. You said it's coconut milk is working for you now, right?
Yeah, I'm... Everything is new, you know. I drink goat milk, so I'm learning to like coconut milk. I cooked beet greens for the first time. It's a very strange new world. It's only week one.
It's only week one. And for those of you guys who are listening, if you listen on the podcast, our setup does look a little different. Luckily, all of us are shelter in place right now. Ryan and I and Ileana are in three separate screens, and we're making it work.
Yeah, right. It's good to see you. I miss you guys.
I know, we miss you too, but this is like close to the same thing, right?
Yes, sort of. The biggest thing for me is it's only been a week. 1 week ago,
I know.
I saw you guys that night. I left the studio and I said, I think I'll go to the supermarket, and it was Armageddon. That's when I realized things, you know, were really bad. It was zombies, you know, nothing. And it was just complete craziness. I could only get food that I could hold in my hands and put in my own bags. It was really crazy. So,
well, the best part, Ileana, I don't know if I can mention who, but you reached out to a very specific actor on air who sort of had a prophecy about what this would look like. And it seems like he was right.
Yes. Wait, who is it? I'm blanking.
If I'm okay to say it on air, it's a friend of the show, Ed Begley Jr. He's the one who knew.
Because I've always said my motto with everything in life is when in doubt, ask Ed Begley. And he was the first person. I think it was Thursday night, I emailed him. I said, Ed, tell me everything I need to know. You know, I had some questions. Can our pets get it? The answer, you know, the pets can't get it unless we give it to them. But he said he had told me if I could to try to run out to the supermarket one more time, because that was gonna kind of be it. So he pretty much called that.
He knew. I mean, it's a crazy time. Luckily, we still are running the show today. We're very excited. We have author Christina Lane on the show, who wrote this wonderful book and profiled Joan Harrison.
Yes,
such a perfect guest for our show. Ileana is showing off the book now. Let's see it.
Let's see if you can see it. I don't know about the reflections, but anyway, I really love this book. Actually, I provided a quote for it, as that's how much I loved it. And Joan Harrison was just an incredible producer, so I'm looking forward to talking to her about that. But the book is if you like Alfred Hitchcock, you'll love the book, because she was behind so many of his great films. Also, Robert Montgomery. I'm a huge Robert Montgomery fan. He didn't make a lot. He was mainly known as an actor, but he did Ride the Pink Horse and Lady in the Lake, which are two movies that I love.
I love it. Well, what's so cool about Joan Harrison too is that she was a writer, and I feel like so rarely are not only writers, you know, pre-code 1950 really featured, but especially female writers. So I love that about her.
Another question I have for you is, I'm finding it very hard to have any structure to the day, because we're not going anywhere. So if I plan my day around, you know, I mean, normally I would be going to my dance class. I would have my shopping days, or, you know, everything's gone. So I'm finding it hard to kind of know what to do with the day. I'm going out and sort of trying to ride my bike every day. But what about you? How are you finding structure?
I mean, Ryan and I can speak to the fact that our network is trying to still produce remotely, because the one thing that's true about right now is people are watching more television than ever and consuming more content than ever. So we've been pretty busy producing in our own magical way. I mean, Ryan, what do you think?
We've been super busy. I think if an online talk show was ever needed, it's right now. And that's what's made the day's pretty busy. So we're all doing our shows remotely. We're really happy to be doing this one today remotely. And I think people are going to be looking for this content more than ever.
Absolutely. And Ryan, I love you. You're coming a little hot. Just turn down that mic just a little bit.
Turn it down.
There we go. And yeah, if you guys are watching on the YouTube, we're in this little white box studio here in Encino. We're actually doing the shelter in place. So it's kind of a crazy time right now. It's going to be really interesting to see how the entertainment industry bounces back from this. Are you getting any like self-tapes, Ileana?
Well, I've been one. There was, you know, just a voiceover audition, and you know, no one's obviously going in, and most people sort of home record anyway. But as far as meetings, I mean, I had something very important the Friday, and that's obviously gone. And the two work opportunities I had are gone, and I can't imagine things are going to be back to normal until maybe late summer. If I don't really know. I mean, this is, you know, right now it's sort of, you just thinking about 1 hour at a time. I've gone back to writing my film book because that gives me some structure. But as far as other projects, no, nothing is happening. And that's what I've heard from other people.
Yeah, it's wild. The one thing we do have to ask, Christina's going to be on in just a couple minutes, but before we bring her into the show, yes. What are you watching right now?
Oh, I may seem a little sick, but I've been sort of getting into the Armageddon feeling. So I watched, hence, I saw it only once, you know, and I remember I didn't like it, but on Criterion Channel, you know, I always look for what's leaving March 31st. I said, oh, I got to see that. So I rewatched Day of the Locusts, and it's actually an incredible film. It's very dark, but director John Schlesinger, I completely forgot that Donald Sutherland is in it, and his name is Homer Simpson. And I said, oh, that's where they got the Simpsons from. Nathaniel West, book, and Karen Black, and Burgess Meredith is incredible, and lots of shots of early Hollywood.
Wow.
Filmed in the 70s, but supposed to be, you know, Hollywood in the 30s. And then I followed it up last night with Sorry Wrong Number, which is the film where Burt Lancaster kills his invalid wife. You know, she can't get out of bed, and she's trying to convince people to come help her, and nobody helps her, and it's absolutely terrifying. So,
well, Ileana, I'm glad you're keeping it light and cheery during this very interesting time in our in our country.
What about you? Are you?
You know what? Laura and I started this Netflix show called Lock and Key. It's funny. It's good. It's kind of that sort of earnest, straightforward adventure family type of show. I don't know if you're a Stranger Things person or if you've seen any of that stuff. It's I sort of like that. You know, there's so much irony and comedy and so much of what's produced nowadays that sort of like straight ahead earnest tone I sometimes find really refreshing.
Well, what do you think? I mean, I guess this $64,000 question, when this is all over, do you think people will want comedy, or are they going to want movies about, you know, the world is ending?
You know, I feel like we're going to have both camps is probably how it's going to look.
Yeah. I don't really know. And, you know, anyone who says they know is crazy.
I want to say, I know for a fact we're going to get at least a couple hundred short films about being in isolation. Like, that's what everyone's movies are going to be submitted to any festival. They're all going to be that. We're going to get a flood of those movies.
So true.
But don't you think after the first week, you know, because it's like we've gone from, you know, oh, it's kind of interesting, I can do this, but we're only at week one. And already I've seen a remarkable change in people, you know, from, you know, a week ago. Like, I was in the store and there's no food. You know, once you get inside, I've forgotten Trader Joe's, but I got inside one store and there was a guy in front of me and, you know, and trying to hoard food. And the cashier kept having to say to him, sir, there's only two per customer. Oh, I missed two? She said, yes, sir, on all items, you know. So he was trying to get away with, you know, four cans of beans or whatever, and the woman had to keep taking it away from him. So that's what I worry about, the Twilight Zone aspects, you know.
Well, it is 2:05. I think our guests should be calling in soon. So we're going to take a quick break and throw up our slate. But make sure you guys stay tuned. Quick commercial break. We are going to have Christina Lane, author of the Joan Harrison book, Phantom Lady, coming up right after this. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
We're back.
All righty. Hi, everyone. So now we've got Christina Lane on. And as I mentioned, she's written this terrific book. It's called Phantom Lady. Hollywood producer, The Forgotten Woman.
Hi, Eliana.
Hitchcock, hi there. And welcome to the show. Thank you so much for being here under, obviously, these unusual circumstances.
They you are, know, but thanks. Thank you for having me.
No, it's my pleasure. And we, you know, we it was dramatically how things have changed in a week. But, the, you know, the month was set aside for celebrating, you know, women in film and female producers, and obviously Joan Harrison is one of the greatest. But the other thing is, just the book is such a page turner in itself because she lived such an interesting life. So I guess I'm just going to start out for people who do not know anything about Joan Harrison. Who was she to people?
I think her life is a great fodder for a Hollywood movie. Honestly, she's
completely.
She's got a great story, yeah. So, and so, you know, she was born outside of London as the daughter of a newspaper family, and she could have led a life of luxury. You know, she had every kind of the cards stacked in that direction, but she wanted a life of adventure. So Joan Harrison answered this ad that Alfred Hitchcock placed to be a secretary she was 26 years old, and he was just kind of beginning his film career. I mean, he had about 10 years of movies, but he was not the world famous movie director that we think of,
right,
any means. And when he hired her, she started off in the first few weeks as his secretary and proved to be the worst possible secretary, you know, the worst secretary he had ever had. And luckily he saw in her this incredible talent for story and for character and for writing. And he promoted her within just a couple of weeks into that department, basically, and to be her, you know, his right-hand woman. And very quickly, she was writing screenplays for him and came to the United States as basically the only person that he brought to America in the late 1930s. When he came to the U.S., he brought his wife, Alma Revel, who was an instrumental collaborator. We could talk about her uh-huh. work as well. He brought Alma Revel, his daughter, and her with him. And we can talk more about the career, but it went from there.
Well, it seems like, again, from your book, the minute they met, they had a kind of instant chemistry, because even the scene of the meeting, and he asks her, do you speak German? And she says, no, but I speak French. He hires her anyway. And then she lies and says she has to go in to meet him because her sister was having a baby. So where did you find all these great little nuggets of information?
They are great. And there's just a lot of, you're right, there's a lot of chemistry there. There's just, she was very witty and wry. And I think that he caught on to the fact that she was going to be a great character in his life. And she was a great storyteller. So she told, I think, a lot of stories on herself. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that necessarily all of them are true, but she developed this way, I think, of trying to create her own narrative. So, you know, and that story was told so many times that I do believe that that's although some of it was exaggerated, that that's pretty much the way that they met. And it is fantastic because she did apparently just kind of bypass a very long line of women who were much better qualified for that job.
Right.
And then he saw her, he couldn't turn her down. And they went to lunch and began to talk about their interests. And she just loved true crime. You know, she's gone to trials and sat, you know, in the Old Bailey and watched a lot of trials and read a lot of true crime. So he realized immediately that they were kin, you know, that they had the special kind of affiliation over basically movies as well as crime and mystery.
Right. And then, of course, her look, she becomes kind of his muse, because everything about her starts to become infused in his films. Now, is it sort of starting with Madeline Carroll in The 39 Steps?
It sure is. Yeah. So, you know, Joan Harrison comes into his life at the same time, right around The 39 Steps, just maybe a little bit before that. But he was beginning to put that Hitchcock blonde on the screen. And he had this fantasy kind of cinematic vision of the Ice Maiden, who is that kind of burning volcano underneath, you know, with the sexuality kind of just trying to somehow maybe come through, burn through the cold, hard shell. And Joan, yes, at least the people who knew her tell me that she was very much that, like that, yeah. And that she was very kind of erotic, but that she held a lot of that back, especially underneath her sense of humor. And Madeline Carroll was definitely like that in person as well as on screen. So there is this kind of story, especially as Donald Spoto tells it, that as kind of Madeline Carroll was walking in just as Joan Harrison was walking in, and they both entered Hitchcock's kind of cinematic life, right? His fantasy life at the same time. And of course, there's really not much difference between his inner life and what he's putting on the screen. And so I think that he had a way of working all that through.
It seems like they brought out the best in each other. And then, you know, again, this very interesting thing where they all go to Europe, but she uses the name. And I remember even being confused when I first started to get into movies, being confused as to who Joan Harrison was and who I thought she was his wife, because it seemed like they occupied similar roles. Yeah. And she took his name when they were on the trip over to America.
Isn't that so crazy? Yeah, so she signed her name Joan Hitchcock on the ship's charter, even as early as 1937, before they were actually coming over to start work here. And she was definitely part of the Hitchcock family. They were often photographed very close together, whereas his wife, Alma Revel, was off to the side.
And she was put to the side. Yes. And you can really tell in the photos too. Yes. And I think that early on, when I started to be interested in Hitchcock, I really think I think I associated her more for being his wife than his producer.
Interesting. I mean, she was so glamorous, you know, and apparently stunning. I mean, she's stunning in photographs, but people who knew her say that in person, that's what they walked away with most, was just her looks, that she, you know, she was beautiful inside and out.
Yes.
And I think that, you know, they had a long working relationship, you know, from the 1930s all through the 1960s. And then of course they knew each other until he died. And I don't know how to describe it, except we're very complicated. They had a very complicated relationship.
You write about in your book, just a fun little nugget of when she gets to Hollywood and she moves in the Wilshire, is it called the Wilshire Palms?
Yes.
And with all sorts of, God, tell me about that. That sounds like a really fun place to live.
Yeah, so the Wilshire Palms on Wilshire Boulevard, which is very close to the Beverly Hilton, mm-hmm. was a place where a lot of people who were coming through to work would live first before they found housing, before they found their own homes. And they were put up there to write Rebecca. So Joan had this really tiny apartment on the first floor, right? And they were actually, the Hitchcock family were on the penthouse. So they had a wonderful, I think, 3-bedroom place on the top floor with this fabulous view that they could see all the way to Culver City at that point.
Wow.
And they had negotiated a deal, maybe because they didn't have space yet at the Selznick Studios to write, but they could work out of home. So basically Hitchcock and Alma didn't particularly like that third floor space because it was very cold and the walls were white and there wasn't a lot of color. So they would all squeeze into Joan's tiny little apartment where it was warmer. There were pastels and they would just write. They wrote Rebecca there in that tiny, tiny little shell. But you're right. There were Franch Othon lived there. A lot of stars were there at the time. I think Billy Wilder was in and out, and there was a time, I think that Joan and Billy Wilder had a thing. And I'm not quite sure when.
Well, she was okay. It sounds like, again, from your book, she, you know, even though she had the association with Hitchcock, she was romantically involved with a lot of men, John Houseman and Irwin Shaw and all sorts of people.
Yes. Billy Wilder, Kirk Douglas, Sidney Bernstein is definitely someone that she apparently was very close with for a long time. And there's, of course, Clark Gable, which was a very public relationship that she had.
And this was after Carol Lombard had died, right?
Yeah. Because apparently she and Carol Lombard and Clark Gable were really buddy-buddy in those early years. And then after Carol Lombard passed away, I think that she saw a way to be, you know, compassionate and also help Clark Gable after the war, you know, as someone who could kind of chaperone him around. And they became close after that.
Do you think in these early days, it reminds me of a woman's trajectory in show business where it all seems very exciting. Rebecca is just is a masterpiece. She's involved in the casting and all these things. It isn't until later on that she starts to not realize, you know, she's not getting any real credit for this at all. People even are mistaking her for being Hitchcock's secretary.
Yes. Yeah, I think, right. At the beginning, it was fabulous. And, you know, it wasn't long after she got to Hollywood that she received this historic, this historic credit of having both an Academy Award nomination for Rebecca and Foreign Correspondent in the same year, which was something no woman or man had.
Yeah.
So that really kind of launched her into this kind of particular category where then she thought that she could screenwrite, you know, on her own. Mm-hmm. And so at that time, she really thought she could leave Hitchcock and not only screenwrite, but hopefully become her own producer. And it was actually a relatively short window that she had before she began to realize that she couldn't go out there and have the same power and the same credentials that Hitchcock had. So she tried to portray herself as the mistress of suspense. And she had a very strong vision. And when she tried to exercise that, she just didn't receive the same respect from studios or from the Production Code Administration. And so she really did kind of take this, you know, this great leap and then this great fall relatively quickly.
Yeah, so it's after she breaks from Hitchcock kind of around Saboteur. But one movie that I'm fascinated by, I've never seen it, with she worked with Dorothy Arzner, the female director, on a movie called First Comes Courage. So I've never seen that movie. I'm kind of excited to see what this is when she's kind of getting her sea legs.
Right. I mean, First Comes Courage was one of the first films that she wrote when she broke away from Hitchcock. It was in her early stages there. And Dorothy Arzner, being an important female director and someone that most of us know now is very historic, not only as a woman director, but as a lesbian director who had her own imprint, particularly with women's relationships and female bonding on screen, you know. And so it would be interesting to know how much Dorothy Arzner helped to train Joan Harrison to think in really interesting ways, you know. But First Comes Courage was a war movie, and it was not something that Dorothy Arzner herself had a lot of control over, because she began to get sick and she was actually kicked off the picture or taken off the picture and replaced at Columbia. Harry Cohn basically replaced her with Charles Vidor. And at that time, then Joan was also replaced by male writers. And while the film probably wasn't changed all that much, both women felt that their power had been taken away. So yeah, it's hard to say, you know.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's, you know, you think from Rebecca, now she's taken off of a film. So then the next movie she does is Phantom Lady, and that is a terrific film. And that we're going to get to her fall after that, but at least she makes this one great film that's really all of her own.
Yes. Yeah, Phantom Lady is really terrific. It's you know, Robert Siodmak directs, and it contains all of these you know, players, the writers, the actors, the cinematographer, basically felt at the time that they were all kind of breaking through, and it was their big chance to show their talent. Ella Raines stars, you know, as the secretary turned detective.
Oh, and I love her.
That Joan. Yeah, it's a fun film, you know, and a noir that is just quite different than any of the noirs that were being made at the time. And it's a Cornell Woolridge novel that Joan saw a way to twist into more of a female-driven story, because at the time it was much more about the male who's kind of the wrong man, and he's, you know, trying to save his own skin and prove that he was falsely accused. So she basically takes a girlfriend... the girlfriend character and decides to turn her into the main character and a sleuth who's going to save this man's life. But not only does she do that, but she really just trains the entire story so that there are tons of little plot reversals along the way. And she proves herself, because not only does it help her career, but it also helps Universal. And it's one of the very first noirs, some people say the first noir that Universal did. It helped them to elevate their own brand. So it was landmark in a lot of ways. And the truth is that she took an associate producer credit. This is to your point, right? They would not actually give her a full producer credit on that film, right, even though she was a producer. No one was above her except for one, you know, the executive producer kind of at the front office. Mm-hmm. So she took an associate producer credit for that film. And most people who don't know a lot about her career believe that she had maybe a 3-contract deal there. You know, and then something happened where she kind of fell off, but she actually was only given one picture there and then had to kind of scrounge around and ended up going to Hunt Stromberg and thinking that she was making a deal where she was going to co-produce with him, kind of launch a production unit with him.
Right.
And that didn't go well because he didn't want to give her 50%. So she ended up kind of lobbying around until she went back to Universal and did indeed get a 2-picture deal with them. And that just didn't go so well because though they did give her full producer credit at that point, they didn't want to give her all the autonomy that she thought she needed.
And so while all this is happening too, you see all these great pictures of her, very glamorous with the, you know, the suits and the hats and going out to lunch. And I mean, she was really kind of outwardly living the life and seemingly to be this very successful person, but in reality is really sort of kind of scrambling around, it seemed like.
Yeah, I mean, there are a couple things going on. I was really grateful to be able to speak to Norman Lloyd, who is just a fabulous source. I mean, thank goodness he's still here.
Pandemic, as I said, he's gone through.
I know. As you say, he's proof, right? He was here. He's been here before.
105.
Yeah.
Got to make it to 106.
I know. But he, you know, he describes her as really being at the center of the Hollywood universe then, you know, that she was really it, and that she knew everyone, that she was well connected, that she was a driver at that time. And that also she was a fashion icon, right? I mean, she's all over the pages of fan magazines.
Right.
She was not only wearing popular styles, she was really defining the style of the moment and helping to define women's workwear with her movies, Phantom Lady, and also The Strange Affair of Uncle Harry, working with Travis Banton, the designer. So she was, I think this was a way in which she had taken from Hitchcock this notion that you needed to brand yourself. And she understood that she was in of herself an icon, and she could create kind of a commercial, right, of herself, well in advance of some of the other women producers that were her contemporaries. So in that sense, she was actually a little bit more famous, right, than I think we understand. We look back and it doesn't show through history. Mm-hmm. And yet she was floundering behind the scenes to just keep kind of clawing along with the guys, you know, because it was a boys club.
Yeah, it's too bad. So then her trajectory, for whatever reason, she leaves and she ends up at RKO.
Yes.
And then that's where the real kind of fall comes with Howard Hughes, comes in and he sends a memo saying he only wants movies about fighting and fornication, you know, and what is her reaction to that?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think it's really important to emphasize that roller coaster quality of her career, because she's up and then she's down and she's up and then yeah. she's down. A lot of this is because she refused to give right to back down. So, you know, the reason that she went to RKO from Universal is because she had made Strange Affair of Uncle Harry, again, with Robert Siodmak and starring George Sanders and Ella Raines. And she had been promised that she could have an ending that she wanted and had written. And the Production Code Administration, the PCA, actually, who would have, you know, been in charge of maybe handing down some censorship policies or encouraging censorship, they had actually okayed the film as well. And somehow at the last minute, the studio got cold feet and tried to renege on their agreement. And she said, again, you know, I stand by my film and you're not going to tell me how, you know, how to show the film. And so she walked out essentially on, again, like a three picture deal and the film that she had in the can. But she rebounded by going to RKO. Mm-hmm. And she made a couple of great films at RKO. She made Nocturne, starring George Raft and Lynn Barry. And then she made They Won't Believe Me, which is a fabulous film. You know, it's just really great. And it doesn't get shown enough these days. But at that point, Howard Hughes took over the studio at RKO and she saw the writing on the wall. And she realized that They Won't Believe Me had been hard enough to get made because it was very risque, very controversial. Mm-hmm. And yeah, indeed, Howard Hughes sent out a memo saying, you know, no more movies unless they have fighting or fornication. And she thought, neither of those are my cup of tea, and just walked right out.
So during all this time, is she in contact with Hitchcock at all or for advice?
Right. I'm so glad you asked this question because it's a real kind of it's a real misunderstanding or misconception that a lot of people have suggested that she had some falling out when she decided to go solo. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, Hitchcock resented her for this and that they had maybe an 8 to 10 year hiatus. Right. And actually, nothing could be further from the truth. And they were the fam, you know, she and the family were quite close, and she would continue to socialize with Hitchcock and Alma Revel, and she continued to play this auntie role to their daughter, Patricia Hitchcock. She would dog sit, you know, for them when they were in New York, and also consult with them. So she was, it wasn't as though she stepped out of her role of story and script consultant on the films that we see in terms of Notorious or Strangers on a Train and Rope. And then, you know, and I think the same with Hitchcock. I think that Hitchcock was giving her, you know, certain ideas for her films, and which means it's important, I think, in film history, if you see continuities or similarities in the work, it's not as though, you know, she would be plagiarizing, right, from him or vice versa. They were in a really important conversation during mm-hmm. the 1940s.
So then her next collaboration fascinates me. How does she meet Robert Montgomery and starts working with him?
Right. And very interesting, you know. And so, you know, they may have met actually back in Britain because he did a Hitchcock film in Britain. He started.
Oh, right. Yeah. which one is it? Mr. and
Secret Agent. I think it would have been
Secret Agent. Secret Agent.
Sorry. Yeah. And I'm not going to give you a spoiler on that, but he played a bit role in that film. So uh-huh. she might have actually known him from then, but he was on a nice roll coming back from World War II when he made The Lady in the Lake, and he was looking for creative freedom. So they both basically joined up at Universal, and he had a new production company called Neptune. And he saw her as a fabulous asset because as a director and an actor who wanted to direct himself in pictures, right. He needed somebody who could be a really strong producer. So while he had a lot of freedom in his own production unit, and technically he could have been a producer, he just obviously didn't have the time for the business part of it. And I think that this is where she really doesn't get the credit she deserves, is most people attribute Robert Montgomery's films, you know, to Robert Montgomery. And most of those really should be seen as well as Joan Harrison films.
Oh, especially, which is my favorite one. I mean, I could turn the camera. I've got a huge poster of Ride the Pink Horse.
Isn't it great?
It's one of my all-time favorite movies. It suffers a little bit, maybe because of the, you know, it doesn't have a lot of money, but I love the movie. I love the movie. So tell me about that. It's based on a book and her whole discovering of finding the book and turning it into a film.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a Dorothy Hughes novel, and also, a reminder that Joan Harrison loved women's material. She was a real literary influence in terms of bringing women's books to Hitchcock, bringing women's books to Robert Montgomery, and also developing a women's literary material for her entire career. And again, I think that it gets lost that she brought Dorothy Hughes's novel to Robert Montgomery.
Yeah.
As the idea. And that is one of those things I found in my research, actually by reading the oral history of Robert Boyle, right? The production designer is the person who made a note of this, and I'm not sure that it has come out before. Mm-hmm. And so that was like her baby. You know, she really did think of this as a novel that she wanted to grow. It's got a great screenwriting behind it. It's Charles Lederer and Ben Hecht. So the dialogue is incredible. And, you know, they are the credited screenwriters, and I give them all their due. But I do know that she worked on it in kind of adapting it right before they came along, and then worked with them on the script. And it's one of these fabulous films, partly because of that character of Pilar, the young girl.
And it was incredible. That's why I say, you know, the casting, she's not really Mexican, but their relationship, Robert Montgomery's relationship with her, I just think is so, that's the whole beauty of the film, I think.
Yes.
Is the sensitivity between them. They're growing affection mm-hmm. for each other, even though she's a child and he's a grown man.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's this fabulous final moment, you know, where the film, you think that he's going to try to like let her off easy as he says goodbye. And the entire, you know, kind of scenario leads you to think that they're either going to get together, which would be like the happy ending, you know, the Joan Harrison always hated happy endings.
Right.
This lead you to believe this, or that Robert Montgomery is kind of sidle up at the end of this. So it looks kind of like a Western movie all of a sudden, and leave her off in the sunset to say goodbye. But actually she's the one who lets him off easy and says, you know, really, it's time for you. I understand it's time for you to head on out, and he leaves disappointed, but the camera actually remains over there with her, right? Yeah. And her community. And she's left telling her story of the story, which is just a fabulous touch.
Oh, it's a beautiful film. I hope everyone sees it, Ride the Pink Horse. So what happens to her after Ride the Pink Horse? Is that then she gets married, or?
Not yet. Yeah, there's like another decade before she gets married.
She got married, so
I got to tell you.
She's meeting a lot of people, but she never really, you know, what was it about Eric Ambler that made that? So Eric Ambler ends up being the person she marries, but do you think she was afraid of losing her independence?
Yeah, yeah. Well, can I just insert very quickly that, you know, she does make Robert Montgomery this comedy called Once More, My Darling, you know, after Ride the Pink Horse,
which
is really off-brand for her, but a total romp. It's worth, you know, it's worth catching. And then she makes these two films in Britain. She goes with Robert Montgomery and makes a film, and then she makes another film on her own. So she continues to work, and then she makes these television series with Ella Raines called Janet Dean, Registered Nurse, which are really interesting TV shows. But it is a really interesting question in terms of her personal life, to jump back to your question, and why it was she waited so long to marry, and then why it would be Eric Ambler, the person who supposedly invented the modern spy novel, right? The spy novel. in 1958, so she was 51 years old when she finally married. And specifically your question is?
Well, I said, you know, was she concerned about, you know, giving up her independence in some way, or did she see her career kind of waning? Because she's going to have a terrific third act, which we're going to get to.
Yeah.
But I would imagine being a 50-year-old female producer would seem kind of scary.
Right. Right. Yeah. So, you know, she was very, one of the things that's interesting about Harrison is the way that she didn't shy away from critiquing in public, you know, on kind of in print and right out there out in the open, critiquing marriage and romance and the institutions around, you know, marriage and family. Mm-hmm. Even as early as like 1941, 1942, and even going into the post-World War II era when this was becoming much less fashionable, right, as mores became more conservative. So I think partly, you know, partly she was a career woman and she saw, you know, on the one hand that she just didn't really want to make much time and there wasn't much room for marriage and family. And she specifically said she wasn't a very kind of maternal person. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, she also saw this in a more ideological way that she did not believe in the institution of marriage. And that it was almost like a stance, you know, that she was taking. I do not want to get married because it is not a good thing for culture. And these views kept coming out in her movies. So it was a way in which she just didn't have a place for it in her life, nor in her, you know, kind of in her social and cultural like perspective.
I have a quick question on that, if I could hop in. Christina, do you think if Joan would have kind of like played ball more with like social and moral codes of the time, she would have had an easier time hobnobbing with these sort of like traditional conservative Hollywood execs?
That is a very good question. I think that it might be true. I think you're onto something because she certainly wasn't the kind of person that would, you know, play up to their expectations, you know, especially in social settings. So, I mean, she did a nice job, I think, of dancing around and being tactful with, say, you know, male executives who might be trying to, you know, like flirt, right, or mm-hmm. come on to her. So she had very clear boundaries, and she was, you know, she was somebody who really knew her way and would kind of keep that clear. And that also might have also caused some problems along the way for her career, right? Because she wasn't, she was not going to say, you know, sleep with someone to work her way up, right?
Right.
But on the other hand, she also wasn't seen as a conventional woman, and that could have created a threat, right? She was seen as a threat in that sense. I think you're right.
Interesting. Yeah.
Well, there was always, didn't she get some pushback because people thought she'd slept with Alfred Hitchcock in order to, you know, get her start? Yeah. She always had to kind of push back on that.
She always did. Yeah. There was, a lot of insinuation. There was just kind of a lot of whispering or wagging tongues, as they say. And mm-hmm. she, you know, that was unfortunate that she had to contend with that over and over again. She, you know, she was very clear that for her there was nothing romantic, nor was there really. She may have had to contend with sexual harassment a little bit early on, but she put that to rest and then went on, you know, with her career with him. Yeah.
What were the in your research? I mean, well, first of all, I didn't even ask you what was your interest, because this is really the first major book about Joan Harrison. I mean, up until then, I'd always find little snippets about her. But what was your interest to write a book about her?
It's actually exactly what you say. You know, I'd been kind of told about her, say, in a film director's class or a Hitchcock class when I was doing film studies. And the thing is that I just kept going through my time. It's been like 20 years. And people would say in books or on DVD commentaries, oh, that Joan Harrison, you know, somebody should really write a book about her, or she's so important. You know, and I just thought, well, gosh, if nobody's gonna do it, then I should do it. Somebody's gotta do it. And the thing about that is that the more that I like, they're just the more that I would find something, I'd pull on a little thread and I would say, wow, I cannot believe that, you know, there's so much here. She did so many films that actually I didn't even know, right, that she worked on. So many scripts that she was uncredited on. And also just she was such an interesting personality. And that was one reason why I wanted to do a biography as opposed to an academic work, because I feel like you kind of want to figure out who she was before you even begin to open up other questions that might be a little bit more academic.
Yeah, I think I agree with you that she kind of created, you know, she was so smart in branding herself and almost creating an archetype for what we think of as of the modern female producer. You know, when you think of a Kathleen Kennedy, they all seem to be in the mold of someone like Joan Harrison. Powerful, not too powerful. Pretty, not too pretty. You know, it's very interesting slash weird. You know,
she walked an incredibly fine line. Again, you know, the actresses that worked with her in the 1950s, for example, would say, gosh, you know, she was feminine but masculine. And, you know, again, as you say, she was really quite adept at playing, you know, a lot of different sides at once, again, to remain strong and powerful.
So then how long after that then she comes back in Hitchcock's life to start doing Alfred Hitchcock Presents?
Yeah, so in the mid-1950s she was actually pretty down and out. You know, she had had to go to Europe actually because she'd been worried about the blacklist and McCarthyism, and she had had a sense that she was at least gray listed, you know, if not blacklisted. So she had basically pulled herself away from Hollywood. And then she had this opportunity to direct television with Ella Raine. So she was in New York, but that show was canceled after its first season and pretty much kind of definanced. So she saw that there was nothing in front of her. Like she was just looking at a big void. And lucky for her, the Alfred Hitchcock Presents series was being developed, but it was Lou Wasserman, right, the, you know, the big MCA agent and Hitchcock's agent, who actually suggested that she would be a great producer for Hitchcock. So it, again, is kind of a misconception. A lot of people say that Hitchcock is the person who brought her back, you know, and suggested that she be his producer. But he was the one. Hitchcock had doubts that she was the right person and that she would really do kind of, it's a lot of work, obviously, to run a TV series. And right. He kept kind of questioning Wasserman, and Wasserman said, there's nobody else. It is Joan Harrison that is the right person for the job. So so they offered it to her, and she signed right on. And she was essentially what we know of now today as a showrunner for that show for 10 years between the Hitchcock Presents series and then the Alfred Hitchcock Hour.
And is this, are they Universal? So they're on, so this brings her back to Los Angeles now.
Yes.
And she's involved in every aspect of the show.
Every aspect from, you know, top to bottom. Yeah. She's doing, she's choosing all the material. She's getting out there and figuring out the legal rights for the material. She's finding the writers. She's doing casting, and then she's there kind of nuts and bolts every day. The best thing, and I should say, you know, the one thing is that she's not kind of on the set hovering over the director's chair. Right. But in terms of running the show, and then she brought on Norman Lloyd once she kind of realized that this was going to keep going on and on, and Hitchcock as well. They brought on Norman Lloyd as associate producer. So he worked more kind of on the director's side, you know, and they worked together, but Harrison was definitely the head of the show.
Did you meet anyone else aside from Norman Lloyd that had actually worked with her?
Yes. I mean, you know, I met with, say, Carol Lindley, right, who was who did the show several times, and Susan Conner did the show. So I can't say that I met, you know, with everyone who worked on the Alfred Hitchcock Presents series. What was really helpful when I couldn't meet with directly with people who had worked with Harrison was at least to meet with the children of people who, you know, so Franco Tone's son was really helpful in talking about, you know, Franco Tone, why Franco Tone and Harrison would have worked well together. And then, I mean, it's actually worth talking a little bit, and you can tell me whether it's interesting or not, but
no, please.
One of the best sources were her caretakers, her, you know, it ended up very difficult to find family members because she didn't have any children and, you know, her sisters were not living anymore, but the very best sources were essentially her housekeepers or, you know, her nurse, because she actually died in her nurse's arms. And these were people who loved her and kept the stories that she told very dear to them. Mm-hmm. And actually that nurse had written a 200-page memoir of what it had been like to live with Joan and Eric in their house for the last 10 years. And that's just pure gold. I mean, you know, thank goodness.
Wow, that's amazing. So what are her, what would you say are the her most famous, you know, Alfred Hitchcock Presents that we would recognize?
Oh my gosh. Honestly, there's so many. There's like 10 wonderful ones every single year. So it's hard to say. There's a good one called The Babysitter, which is one that I recommend. Wow. Are there ones that come to your mind? Are there Alfred Hitchcock Presents?
I don't, you know, it's funny because I feel like the way television goes, they used to air them all. I remember seeing them all the time.
Yeah.
And then now in the past 10 years, they seem sort of harder to see. So I'm in the same boat, not remembering them as, you know, as much, of course.
Yeah, there's a good one, The Young One. You know, this is one reason why I wanted to speak to Carol Lindley, actually. And I was happy at the time that she was still alive. There's a really good episode called the Young One that is that treats rape in a very interesting way. I mean, I think that Joan Harrison was ahead of her time in treating issues like sexuality and rape and you know, prostitution. And she basically insinuate a lot of women's issues that weren't being addressed on television in such a mature way.
Mm-hmm. It's, have you noticed, like, again, just with the resurgence that we're more interested in female producers now, has there been more of an interest in your book than you would have anticipated?
Yes. I mean, I do think with the Me Too movement and with so many contemporary issues that I'm happy to see that there is so much interest in Joan Harrison. And also, you know, I think that what we find, right, is basically, you know, it's taken so much, I call it kind of an act of forgetting, basically, you know, to that we really need to have this act of remembering, you know, that what we're encountering today, you know, is this kind of question of, well, wow, who knew there was so much, I don't know whether, you know, whether it's sexual harassment in the industry or keeping women down or lack of resources for promotion of women, you know, kind of all these ways in which women are not empowered in the entertainment industry. But the truth is that there are waves, right? There's kind of ways in which women move up and then they find that, like, it's not going back.
Right.
And so I think that one lesson that Joan Harrison's story teaches us is that women have been, you know, empowered in various cycles of time. And if we can find those stories again, it really helps maybe today, right, to remember those.
I would also say, and forget my dog, sorry, my home studio. I would also say the biggest takeaway, and I'd love to hear your thoughts about this, is that we have to reassess Alfred Hitchcock. You know, in you write in the book, there would be no Alfred Hitchcock in the way we know it without Joan Harrison. But how quickly will other historians reassess Hitchcock based on,
yeah,
will they add a footnote or will they let that go?
Right, right. I truly believe, I mean, obviously, one of the things that I wanted to make a point about is collaboration, you know, so it's not, right. This is not really just about Joan Harrison. There's so many collaborators in Alfred Hitchcock's career, and, you know, men and women. Mm-hmm. And then Alfred Hitchcock was someone who kind of rewrote his own history. So he did like to take a lot of credit, you know, yeah. And therefore he just kind of did overshadow a lot of people who put work into his film. And yet a lot of women, I guess I would say women tend to get more obscured in all of that, right? Than some of the men who have been written about, I guess. And so we have people like Alma Revel, but we also have J. Preston Allen, you know, who wrote Marnie. We have Sally Benson, who wrote Shadow of a Doubt with Alma Revel. We have Daphne du Maurier's influence on Hitchcock. You know, if we begin to kind of pull it out, there's also a lot of women in the 1920s who had a strong influence on the way that Hitchcock even approached movies, mm-hmm. that have begun to be rediscovered. So there's a way in which, especially I think in the 1960s and the 1970s, when you begin to get that interview with Truffaut and Hitchcock, and that just frames everything in terms of auteur theory, and the fact that you know, then it's very difficult to go back and try to reroute or rechannel the way that history is written, and yet, and therefore, I guess just to point out or return to this point that particularly Joan's influence needs to be highlighted, because, you know, so many people have said, you know, well, Joan Harrison, we would not even know her name, she wouldn't have even gotten to Hollywood without Hitchcock, but I do want to reverse that formula and suggest that she was so important to him.
Right.
You know, she defined.
I think that that's often the thing that people assume, that it's the woman getting the leg up, when in fact Hitchcock spotted in her, you know, this muse of which he based so much. I mean, you can't look at Vertigo, Kim Novak, because, you know, you think of when you're a kid and the first time, you know, in seeing Hitchcock movies, you're like, geez, the woman doesn't look very attractive. You know, like his vision of a beautiful woman wearing a gray suit with a flattened hair, I never really understood until you start to look at Joan Harrison and you go, well, that's the Gooey's. You know, he's not making, the woman doesn't turn into Marilyn Monroe.
Right.
You know, I always thought that was the odd thing. He takes somebody like Kim Novak and puts her in this gray suit. Like, why does he think that's so attractive? And so critics attributed it to some kind of weird fetish.
Right.
In actuality, when you look at all the photos of Joan Harrison wearing a gray suit, you say, she's turning her into Joan Harrison. So that's what you have to reassess, I think. And I don't know if men or the male critics are going to want to do that. Because I've heard for 20 years, male directors talk about Vertigo in terms of their own fantasy life. And so I think they're going to have a very hard time suddenly attributing that to anything other than it being in Hitchcock's own mind. You know?
No, I do see what you mean. And you know, I was actually very nervous about writing the book and having the book come out, because I thought that it was, susceptible or vulnerable to attacks from people who had were rigid in their way of thinking about Hitchcock. And I'm actually really heartened by the fact that none of that has happened so far, and that those very critics that I might have feared have actually been quite supportive and really said positive things, whether to me personally, you know, or in terms of endorsing the book, or just, you know, kind of giving really nice public praise. So far, so good. but I do want to just highlight the fact that a lot of times women do, and in Joan Harrison's case, she was seen as an appendage for many, many years, right? Her story was basically a side show, you know, to Hitchcock's life. Yeah.
Well, I think that's still kind of the way that films are marketed. I think
executives and studios love to create this narrative of like the genius wunderkind director who drives the whole ship. But film is an incredibly collaborative medium. And I still really believe that our sort of like pedestalization of oftentimes male directors is still a huge problem.
Yeah. Yes. It is. I mean, it continues, right? It continues on. Despite the fact that we know that film is an industry and it's a collaboration, we still retrench back into that romanticization and the mystique of the director.
Mm-hmm. Well, Christine, thank you so much for being on the show. Tell people how they can get your book too.
Okay, great. Well, they can go to Chicago Review Press. .com for a book. They can also, I'd love to steer people to authorchristinalane.com because I'm doing a lot of blogging and also sending out newsletters to keep the research on Joan Harrison going. So authorchristinalane.com and chicagoreviewpress.com. Thanks.
I think, you know, it's a really fun read, you know, it's not only informative, but it's really a page turner just because she lived such a great life. Her life is so interesting. And I think it'll really be inspiring to people just to kind of see how she maneuvered herself from place to place, you know, like its own little spy novel. You know, she just was a very interesting woman on her own. And I love the idea that, again, she wasn't just a female producer. Men seemed to be fascinated by her. You really get so much out of the book. So thank you for writing it. And I hope people will get it. And do you have any next projects coming up? Or
I have got one in the works, and I'm just going to keep it a secret for now. But please stay tuned.
Yeah, that's all we're going to be doing. Next month is going to be a lot of reading and a lot of writing. So I hope people will read the book. I got to hold it up one more time.
Thank you.
No, thank you so much for being on the show. As I said, I love the book. I hope everybody gets it.
All right.
Ready. Christina, have a great day, and we'll talk soon. Bye.
Bye.
And of course, thank you all for tuning into the film scene here on the Popcorn Talk Network. Ileana and I right now are still kind of booking and doing everything we can to keep going through despite Corona. So stay tuned on the podcast feed. Stay tuned on the Popcorn Talk. Also, Alfred Hitchcock Presents is currently streaming on Hulu. So if you want to check that out, you should. That was really the young one, which you're welcome. And the young one, which Christina mentioned, was actually directed by Robert Altman, which I had no idea. But very interesting stuff. So make sure you guys check that out. Christina, thanks again one more time for being here. And Ileana, you want to bring us out of here?
Well, as we always say, we end the show. Everyone's life is like a movie. It's a pretty scary movie this week, but with a beginning, a middle, and an end, this too shall pass. And I send everyone my blessings and try to breathe and get some exercise and stay safe. Stay indoors if you can. It's so important. And just try to send out some loving vibes to the world, especially to Italy. I've got so many friends and relatives in Italy, and what's happening there now is really making me sad. But we're going to continue to, we're rearranging some stuff, and we're going to hopefully bring more guests to you. But for the time being, everyone have a great day and be safe out there. Alrighty, so long.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.